All right. Welcome, folks. Welcome back to Larger, Freer, More Loving. As always, I'm Matt Levine.
I'm Dwight Lewis.
And well, friends, it's been a minute since we've been with y'all. And when that's been the case in the past, we've tended to tell you a bit about where we've been. But to be honest, we don't really feel like we've got time for that at the moment. We've got to get right into our topic, which is the horrific dumpster fire that has been the first 3 weeks of the second Trump administration. And so just jumping right in there, Dwight, why is it so important for you that we have something to say right now?
Yeah, this is first off, I want to acknowledge pain. I want to acknowledge mourning. I want to acknowledge the people that are going have been going through us for the last 3 weeks. Me and Matt have been talking a lot over the last 3 weeks. And I will even say this, one of the things that this second term has done is even brought me and Matt
Brought
back
us closer back
together.
together,
Yeah,
right?
and it brought us back to this podcast because we're all going through particular things and having to mourn this in different types of ways, whether it's crying, whether it's yelling, whether it's whatever it might be. I know me and Matt have done it all, and I know some of you have as well. And so I think what was so important and why me and Matt decided to do this podcast, particularly the focus here is on the community, on not so much focused on the academy or on universities, but really focused on us. And I think it's really important because we've been in such a tumultuous position for the last 3 weeks. And some of us even longer than that, right? And so this is just a really tough thing, not just for our undocumented community, community members that are non-citizens, the Native American community, trans and disabled folk, Black folk, brown folk, our folks that are queer, our folks that are existing in all different types of marginalized positions. It seems like we've walked away from DEI hires to DEI fires, and we're not just talking about jobs, but in our lives. And so I think, and me and Matt talked a lot about this. The thing that I have is a lot of nerves, and a lot of nerves in relationship to the community, right? I'm worried, but I'm also resolute. Right. As you can see, even from this, me and Matt have been brought back together in a way and revitalized this podcast. And I think there are ways that when we are nervous and in these situations, we end up circling the wagons, right? And so I think there's a way where, of course, the nerves are hitting. I started out that first night I watched his acceptance speech. I stayed up to like 3, 4 in the morning. I did it. And then I went to work the next day and I came home and cried, right? And then I was distraught. I was like, I can't believe this is happening. All of these executive orders, this, and that. And then I got mad, and I'm not even gonna lie, I think I punched my wall at one point. Feel bad about that. And then, the Black and brown folks and Native Americans that have come before us in the United States, a shift took place. And I knew that there was a history in my body for responding to this type of information, this type of violence, right? And my body was automatically being like, you've got to mourn, you've got to get through this. And then the middle of that second week, towards the end, it was just like, you have to do and connect. And how do we go about doing that? And so this podcast, this episode particularly, and the episodes that we'll be giving after this, are really about how do we connect, How do we deal with our nerves? How do we shift our mindsets? How do we deal with white supremacist settler colonialism? What does that look like? What do we know about the shock doctrine? And so I think this is really about trying to, I was just listening to, and I'm gonna look like a fool right now because I'm blanking out on his name. Whoa, who am I thinking about?
I don't know.
Politician, old white guy, super progressive,
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders. I haven't heard his name in so long. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, Bernie. You're never gonna see this, but I apologize already. So I was just listening to Bernie Sanders, and Bernie was like, "What we need to do is get clear about particular things." He's like, "All of this is going on. How do we get clear about particular things, and not just in relationship to the administration, but clear in relationship to ourselves as we live in community? How do we get clear about those things?" I really think the focus here today is on that. So, yeah, Matt, why is this so important to you?
Can I just say like plus one to everything you said there? But no, I really so appreciated everything you said there. And like, I'm proud of you for crying. I'm proud of you for getting angry. I'm proud of you for sharing about that in community in resolute ways, like you said. I'm proud of you for listening to the wisdom of your body. And I'm proud of you for doing all of that, especially at a time when there are such assaults on Black bodies, on brown bodies, on Indigenous bodies, on trans bodies, on women's bodies. And I think it's important that we name all of those things, and I think it's important that we be as openly and explicitly pluralistic about communities as you were in coming into this, because I just came from a space. I was just this last week up in Chief Dry Geese territory, what's now known as Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories and what's now known as Canada. And a wonderful, wonderful human being I got to meet up there, Erica, Gwich'in woman. I gave an invocation, a land honoring on the first day I was there. And one of the things she talked about was some wisdom she heard from one of her elders that implicit inclusion is really just erasure. And at a time like this, I think calling in explicitly all of the communities that might be hurting, that might be reeling, that might be mourning, that might be grieving right now, is a particularly important thing to do.
And I want to do that with you too. Like, thank you for standing alongside us. Thank you for fighting for us. Like, I'm proud of you. And, I don't say this enough, but I'm proud of the white folk that choose not to hide in situations like this, that choose to stand up and stand along marginalized folks that are getting beat up. I really, I'm at a loss at times when I see particular white folk standing up in this space when it's so easy to hide behind a curtain, right? And we've seen this all throughout history, people hiding behind curtains. And so, I'm proud of you. Thank you for not doing that. And also thank you to everyone who's out there listening who's not doing this. Now you're gonna have to keep choosing, right? That's a choice you're gonna have to keep making. And I think, we're gonna see throughout this administration how choices like this get harder and harder and harder and harder. And there's ways that, dang, I'm gonna say something, that somebody's like actual bodies may not have the history of trauma, strolling through their bodies in relationship to this type of work. And so they're gonna experience a level of trauma that they're not used to, and their bodies are gonna be, giving them, they're gonna be experiencing it in their bodies in ways that they're not used to. And so I'm like, take care of yourself in this situation, but know that this is also going to, affect you. And I'm not saying you particular, but it's like some bodies in ways that it's some bodies are just really prepared for it. And so I'm just like, it's gonna be hard. And to work through the difficulties, and the only way that we're gonna work through these difficulties, is in community.
In community. Oh, right. You couldn't possibly be more right. It's interesting. I got a text this past week from somebody we've had on the show, my mentor, Dr. Claudia Ford. And
Yes,
one of the things
grandmother
she,
epistemology.
right? Hell
Right,
yeah.
grandmother epistemology. Y'all need to get up on it. Get up on it.
And so one of the things she said in this text is just remember at this moment, as much as any other, that being in community is activism.
Nope.
And so that's just been something that's been going through my head constantly. And so one of the things we can do in community, and I appreciate you naming how hard things are right now, because one of the things we can do in community is resource each other with how we're dealing with how hard things are. And so the ways you've been talking about impact on bodies at this moment makes me want to just bring up two resources. One is My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies by Resmaa Menakem. Please, folks, if you're listening, take a look at this book right now. Think about how the world is impacting our bodies. Think about how the ways in which we're responding to the world is impacted by our bodies, and how the way in which the world has racialized our bodies has a huge deal to do with how we're going to impact and be impacted at the moment. And another resource on that front, Ruth King's Mindful of Race, Transforming Racism from the Inside Out. Absolutely, absolutely phenomenal book for thinking about body-based activism at a time like right now, and body-based healing, because we can't do activism without healing. We can't do activism without joy either.
Yes, and I'm sorry I had to grab one. I had to
No,
grab
no.
The Body Is Not an Apology, The Power of Radical Self-Love by Sonya Taylor. This one also, I
Hell
just
yeah.
two. And I'm sorry I had to run because it was on the bookshelf.
Right?
Yes. So hopefully y'all could take some of these resources. We're gonna try to do this throughout this episode. And one thing that I think we have seen in this space, right? Me and Matt keep talking about community. I love this. Being in community is activism, because it is. And there's so many of so many of us that are, backdoor activists that are doing a lot of work behind the scenes. And then using that activism, that community work, to work through the nerves that are not only in our mind but also in our body. And I know in that, the hardest part is that we're, getting there's an assault taking place
Yeah,
on
right.
our community, right? And this assault requires something of us. It requires us to hold our own. It requires us to stand up. And everyone doesn't have to stand up in the same way.
Same way, right?
Yeah, I think everyone thinks that they need to be out here doing a podcast, or they need to be out there marching, or they need to be out here doing this. There's plenty of ways to show up and be in community, right? Which is activism, right?
Right.
What I'm walking towards here is that in that, no matter what, the standing up takes place. And what, because of this assault, resistance to this assault is necessary,
Yeah,
right?
right. Resistance is absolutely necessary, and a community of resistance, a community of struggle is absolutely necessary. So yeah, again, you ask me, why is it so important for us to do something like this podcast right now? It's because there needs to be resistance. We all need to be a part of it, and we all need to be a part of it in whatever way makes sense for our bodies, for our lives, for our families, for our communities. I so appreciate you naming that. I'm constantly got going through my head, you know, Malcolm's and Friends Fanon's, by any means necessary. And I think sometimes people read that in too limited of a way. They read that as, we need to just be willing to go outside the system. And that absolutely positively means we need to be willing to go outside the system. But it means if we need to be inside the system, if we need to be attacking the system from within, if we need to be deceiving the system from within, if we need to be gaming the system from within, if we need to just be surviving the system from within, all of that needs to be a part of our resistance. And all of us need to see all of these different ways of being, knowing, and doing in resistance together as part of a solidarity of resistance and resilience together. And so I like to talk a lot. I love to spend
You
time with
better,
you.
you
I
better.
love to spend time with you. So this is part of my resistance at
Listen,
this moment.
so I have like, I was just talking how Bernie was talking about, that we need clarity. What does clarity mean in resistance? Or does resistance need clarity? What is like, how do these two things, I guess, work in relationship to each other, clarity and resistance?
Oh, that's an absolutely wonderful, wonderful question, especially because it's been a minute since we've been on this podcast. So folks might forget that larger, freer, more loving is a reference to James Baldwin. And so it's at a moment like this that I'm inclined to bring in some of the wisdom of James Baldwin, who always reminds us that not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. And his 1962 is much truth as one can bear. And so I hear something like, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced, as if we are going to change the systems around us, we need to be able to systematically face what's happening around us. We need to be able to systematically name what's happening around us, and we need to be able to do that in community. And so, in my mind, that involves recognizing that the horrific shit around us does not happen haphazardly. The shit that's happening around us, the horrific shit that's happening around us all of the time right now, happens in systematic ways, in ways that we can spot patterns in. And where we can spot patterns, we can predict. And where we can predict, we can prevent. And so, in my mind, that clarity and resistance coming together is about us being able to have collaborative, coordinated community of resistance in all of us seeing some things similarly in clear ways so that we can spot those patterns, so that we can collectively predict, so that we can collectively prevent.
So before this, of course, like while we were planning the episode, we were chit-chatting about this, about what does clarity look like in relationship to this administration. And I think like communally, we've already talked about the weight of this, right? And I think there are two things that me and Matt really leaned on, and one of them was Shock Doctrine, right, by Naomi Klein. And then Matt also brought up white supremacist settler colonialism. I'm gonna ask Matt to tell us what Shock Doctrine is and tell us what white supremacist settler colonialism is also.
Absolutely. This idea of the shock doctrine and disaster capitalism comes from a Canadian writer and activist, Naomi Klein, who wrote this book in the 2000s as a way to explain some of the structured chaos that the Bush administration was going through in their supposed war on terror, which was really a war on Islam and a war on brown people who have access to petroleum resources that the United States wanted. And so this was a way to explain creating crises for the sake of dividing and conquering, and for the sake of distracting from the real motivations, something that goes back to the 1970s, and something that the United States, the Nixon administration especially, was doing in Central and South America, in Latin America, as a way to destabilize economies there, destabilize communities there, for the sake of, again, creating crises out of which white capital from the United States can benefit. And
So what do you
so.
see Trump doing? I'm like, where do you see Trump using the shock doctrine? Where do you see him using mess to create more space for white capitalism?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is entirely what's going on with there's a new wave of batshit crazy executive orders every day. There's a new set of absolutely ridiculous appointments every day. There's a new wave of absolutely horrific suggestions in the media every day. So it makes it so there's no way to possibly coordinate paying attention to all of the different things that are happening at once. So you get this part of the community focused on the executive order that's putting a pause on all federal grants and loans. You get another group of.
So what I'm hearing right now then is that the way that this doctrine works also is that it knocks on different communities and then separates the resistance effort, right? But even in separating the resistance effort, right, we end up still having things like fall through the cracks. Some communities can't. I mean, I'm sorry to say that some communities struggle to fight in the same ways, don't have as much of this, don't have as much of that. And so it there's I'm hearing here a kind of splintering of the amount of energy that you can invest in particular things. And so if you're focused on, let's just say, black people during this administration, maybe you're gonna not have as much energy to focus on someone that's undocumented or a non-citizen, right? And I've already seen this play out in my life. I was at a particular meeting and we were talking about and I am going to talk a little bit about campus now, but
Of course, let's hear it.
so we're talking about POC BIPOC belongingness on campus. And we're talking about the orders, blah 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 blah. And then one of my friends calls, and we're chit-chatting, and they're like, "Oh, did y'all talk about undocumented and non-citizens?" And I was like, "No." And I was like, "All right, we gotta get back onto this. We gotta make sure that we are bringing in all of these communities and not forgetting, not, and it's not even forgetting, it's that things, like you said, are coming so fast that
You
at
get
times
overwhelmed,
you get
right? It's
overwhelmed."
about literally overwhelmed.
And it's so tough. And so it's like there are ways that now we need to come together even more and keep things that one group is not like intuitively going to be reading about or know so much about, and become and educate each other in the community, right? So then we can know what's going on and be able to speak on it a little bit. Even if it isn't our positionality, even if it isn't the way that we move through the world, we're able to know enough to like stand up in those spaces. I
What?
think, go ahead. Really
No, I
important.
mean, this is why I think the concept of white supremacist settler colonialism is such an important one right now. Because I think it's actually a way to show that all of these communities that are being harmed right now, all of us that are being harmed in these different ways, actually have an organizing principle, an organizing framework to bring us all together.
Yes.
And I want to get to that, but I want to pick up on something you said just a couple minutes ago. You said, part of the fuck shit that is the shock doctrine and disaster capitalism is trying to make it so we can't have enough energy to be able to address it all, trying to make it so we can't possibly have enough energy to address all the harm. So we can't possibly have enough energy to support all the communities that are being traumatized. And so I think it's so important for us right now, especially when we're in community, to remind each other of the importance of rest, to remind each other of the importance of joy, to remind each other of the importance of recharging that energy. And so it may sound like a completely different direction for us to go, but I do want to actually ask you at this moment, very purposefully, what are you doing for yourself right now to create space for joy, to create space for rest? What's happening there?
I'm going to tell you this right now. I'm reading this book right now, Black Joy. It is absolutely, and I really don't know how to say her last name, but it's Tracy Lewis Gigotts.
Okay.
Gigotts. Black Joy, Stories of Resistance, Resilience, and Restoration. And I'm just going to read, and this is in the intro. I'm going to read a little, just a tad bit. She says, Black joy is also a strategy. The wider world dismisses and disregards it as frivolity or at its peril. It is a mechanism for resistance, a mode of resilience, and a master plan of restoration. Blackness is not monolithic, but we know it when we see it. Its scent, its subtlety, its scent is subtle, yet piercing, right? I've been just really enjoying every aspect of this book. Let's see, I may even just go ahead and read some more because it's just like we're here.
Please do, absolutely.
Black folks have always imagined being more when our reality said different. We've used a mirage of things to capture that feeling, but the most important conduit has been our art. Our humanity is forced to live in our imaginations as a kind of holding cell until we can make them realities through our fight. We're gonna be doing a lot of that. We create to reimagine. We create to reimagine. We blaze a path towards reinvention when our creations are stolen and commodified to be when we are told that our place is to do. And what I think, what I really am enjoying about this book is that, Black ontology in the United States has been a doing, right? It's been work, it's been tied to a particular narrative. And she's really trying to push us towards being, right? Towards imagining and creating new futures in this world in our present day, right? Finding little moments of joy, finding little places of refuge. And I'm sorry, this book has been such a refuge for me over the last year. I'm not even gonna lie, I haven't even got that far. I've only got like 80 pages in. But I've reread these 80 pages like three or four times. And I don't know if I'm ready to go to page 81. These first 80 pages. I'm trying to get through the whole book, but it really is a struggle. because I've been fed so deeply by these first 80 pages. And so I think one of the ways that I'm trying to resist for myself, is find spaces of refuge. Find whether it's books, whether it's walking a dog, whether it's cuddling your cat,
Hell
like
yeah, hell
Matt,
yeah.
whether it's having your friends over and having some drinks, whether it's playing baton,
Nice.
or some classic stuff like dominoes.
Nice.
This is just on my table right now. I usually don't have games out, but in this year I put them out just for community,
Yeah,
right?
right.
So I think the ways that we can really make space for ourselves and our community within this paradigm is finding little spots of refuge, and they can look different. They can look multiple different ways. But what are you doing to find those places of refuge? We can keep yelling and screaming about what's happening. We can get mad around people. But where do we find the calm in the storm? And I'm telling you this, Native Americans, Indigenous folk, Black people, women have found a way, trans folk, disabled folk, all different types of folk have found a way to exist in the trauma with a type of calm. And how do we do that, right? And I think they have done that well with community and spaces of refuge. And so I'm just pushing you to find those places for yourself. And this is, talking about the people that I learn from, the people I learn about Black Joy from, the people I learn about resistance from, the people I learn about refuge from, has made me add another thing on the top of this white supremacist settler colonialism, which is a patriarchal white supremacist
Right.
settler colonialism, because I'm part of the problem. I exist in a world that's going to elevate me in ways that it doesn't elevate other folk. And I have to choose to be a place of refuge for people that aims at being an anti-sexist, right? That aims at that. And so these are ways also that you can make yourself a space of refuge for other people, right? Over the last, I don't know, man, how long have we known each other? For s
I
7 years?
think 8 years
8
now,
years.
actually. Yeah.
I don't feel refuge around many white people, period. I'm gonna just say it here, and I'll say it often, but I just don't feel safe. And I'm silent right now for a m reason. And, Matt has been a space of refuge for me, amongst white people. Right? And that's activism. That's resistance. That's creating space within a rough paradigm for people to exist, organize, and fight back. Like, that's what it looks like. And so I'm just saying that, like, sometimes we think being a refuge and resistance is bigger than it is. And sometimes it's just being there for people that are getting hurt by people that look like you, that move like you, that do this like you. Right. I think, and I'm not gonna lie, I'm gonna say this, and I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot right now, man. But
No, please keep
I'm gonna say
talking.
this, Black people, you ain't gotta do nothing right now. You're gonna do it either way, but you don't have to do anything right now. If people that are not black want to burn this place down. Black people should let it go, but we're not going to. And we keep up showing up in this. We keep showing up in this place over and over and over and over for the U.S. So do our Native brothers and sisters. They keep showing up, keep existing in a space that's always trying to annihilate them. And I'm sorry, I'm just gonna say this. You don't have to do anything, even though I know you will. Your body has been training you to respond like this for 300, 400 years. And so there's no way. There's no way not to. But I'm giving you the space for those that need it to find refuge and distance. You know?
And
Yeah.
please don't apologize for saying that.
Yeah.
That's not only not something you need. Oh man, my logician brain is kicking in, and I got like way too many negatives in there. You are absolutely right. Not only do you not need to apologize, that's a gift for us. You just gave us a gift.
Yeah, these are the type of things though that you say in the wrong space, and I'm not safe, right?
Right. And that's what,
No, go.
no, and that's why I do want to name too, on top of that, mentioning that black folks don't need to be doing anything right now. White folks, that does not apply to us. We need to be doing things right now. We need to be recognizing that not only have the explicit white supremacists for the last 533 years been the scoundrels, but it's us white moderates, us white liberals, us white progressives that have been the scoundrels just as much. And we need to recognize that we have a huge obligation at this moment. A huge obligation at this moment. And we have a huge obligation for our fellow human beings who are black, indigenous people of color, but we have an obligation to ourselves right now. Because I'm a big believer, along with Grace Lee Boggs, that white supremacist, capitalist, settler colonialism robs us white folks of our souls. And so we need to come at this, in my mind, with the approach of that wonderful wisdom from Australian Aboriginal elder Lila Watson, that if you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come because you recognize your liberation is bound up with mine, then let's work together. And so, white folks, right now, we've got an obligation to see the ways in which we've been complicit in the system, to see the ways in which we have been harmful to others, to see the ways in which we need to be and can be places of refuge, like you've named. So I'm gonna go ahead and be 100% positive here that you do not say I've been a place of refuge for you because I haven't fucked up. I obviously have fucked up,
You have
right?
to. And we have to make space for people to do that.
Right.
It's only when you screw up and you give me testimonial injustice, right? It's only when you mess up and I try to tell you, and I'm sorry, my words are just going to mean less in this type of world, right? It's only when you make my words mean less. It's only when you're not listening to the people around you that are like living a thing, not just reading about a thing, right? People, there's, you know, I talk about this all the time. There's a staunch difference between someone that is a bike ex expert that is knows everything about riding bikes, knows all the different types of bikes, knows all the components, and someone that is just rid that has rode, rid, whatever it is, bikes
Yeah, I don't actually know which
for
it
15, 20, 30 years. Like, you just know different things, right? You know a lot about what this person has told you about writing, but you don't know the actual phenomenal existence of existing on that bike seat. And I think these are just very different knowings, insider and outsider knowledge. And I think that we need to be real about that. And that, maybe someone in front of you is telling the truth and they're telling you their truth, right? Because blackness is not a monolith, right? And I've learned that 100 times over, moving from Florida, from the South, where blackness is not a monolith, but we move as a unit down there to moving up here to, Minnesota, Minneapolis, where, woo, man, blackness became super multiplicitous as soon as I stepped down here. And so a black person up here may say one thing to you that I'm never gonna say, right? But that person is being true about their experience within their locality and their space, right? And so my experience being in Florida and coming up here, being in the South, being Florida, Texas, Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky, it's like very different. And I've lived in all those states, very different than up here. And so my understanding, my answers to some of the things will be very different. Someone from up here, yeah, it's just like what I'm telling you is that the black person in your space, the brown person, the trans folks, the undocumented, the non-citizen, the disabled person in your life, it's telling you their experience. Maybe listen, and stop thinking you as a non-knower can know more, right? You as this non-knower knows more, and it's like, no, maybe you should just sit back and listen, just for a second. You know what Jose Medina tells us in the Epistemology of Resistance is he tells us there's particular characteristics that goes along with being marginalized and privileged, and you can be marginalized and privileged in all different types of ways, right? You could present as a man in this world. You could be white. You could be able-bodied. You could be upper middle class or rich, wealthy, right? These are all ways. But what you end up doing is, the closer you are into the norm, the power norm, you don't have to worry about those things that are further out towards the periphery, right? So you just get to look into power. You don't have to know about those things. But the person that's way out here has to work in through power. So they have to transition to power. Transition, and I'm going to use whiteness here, transition to whiteness. They have to translate for whiteness. They have to resist whiteness as they're doing this too, because they're still not white, right? And so it's like they're, and, but because this person is down here, closest to power, they get to be ignorant about the things that are behind them. And then they get to talk arrogant. And this is why you're gonna fail. It's not that you could care so much and still fail because you're ignorant and arrogant. And this isn't, and I'm not trying to come for you. I'm trying to tell you, stop being ignorant and arrogant and listen, right?
And let's be a team, in fact,
Yes, yes.
right?
And when we talk about team, we haven't talked about outside the US context, but we feel for our folks that are outside of the US too. We know that what we do here impacts the entire globe. We feel for Palestine. We feel for Gaza. We feel for Congo. We feel for Ukraine. We feel for all of these different places all throughout the globe that are hurting and being beat up. We feel even for Colombia in relationship to Trump did last week. We feel for the things that I'm getting from Florida in relationship to Venezuela, right? We feel for these folk. We also feel for, and this is a tough one after what I just said, but we feel for our Jewish brothers and sisters, especially resisting alongside us throughout the freedom struggle here in the United States. I don't have much to say about the community outside of the United States, but the ones in the United States, we feel for y'all. We know that, the Proud Boys and these people that are on the alt-right have been just as anti-you as they've been anti-us at points. And we understand that unlike every other group, you voted almost 80% on the left, right? You voted almost the same percentage as black folk did. And so we commend you for that work. What we want to say to that community here today, and I'm gonna do it, this was not planned, is thank you for who you are. Please keep giving the grace to folks that is foundational to your people and their God. Please give it, keep giving, grace and love and care for folks that are all over. Keep giving that love, grace, and care. And we know that's part of you.
Right.
Know that's part of you.
I so appreciate you saying that, Dwight. And again, this brings up another resource I want to bring in here. If folks are interested in thinking more about some of the things Dwight just said there, this is a collection called A Land with a People, Palestinians and Jews Confront Zionism. A collection of personal stories, history, poetry, and art. I think a great resource if folks are interested in thinking some more about the important wisdom that Dwight just dropped on us. And also, I really appreciated the ways in which you talked about there's so much epistemology, there's so much knowledge, there's so much possibility of resistance in understanding a multifariousness of stories. Of different stories from so many different subject positions, and that is how we ultimately come together and create a solidarity that doesn't have to be a consensus, right? And so, again, if folks are interested in thinking about this, I want to point out Why Indigenous Literatures Matter. Written by Daniel Heath Justice, a Cherokee academic who works in what's now known as Canada. And one of the things he talks about in this book is understanding the absolutely central importance of story in people coming together and resisting settler colonialism, and in people ultimately understanding answers to some of life's most important questions, questions like how do we learn to be human? How do we behave as good relatives? How do we become good ancestors? How do we learn to live together? And so, yeah, just want to encourage folks to check that out too. Again, thinking about everything there is there and what you named about, again, that multifariousness of stories from all different subject positions.
And we will link a TED talk to this too. And I can't remember the person who did the TED talk, but I know the name of it. But we'll link it in
Are you talking about the danger of a single story? Chimamanda
yes,
Ngozi
this is I start every one of my classes. The first assignment is watching this TED Talk.
How have we not talked about this before?
I don't know either.
This is the only assignment that I give to every single one of my classes.
Yo, this me too. This I give everyone Moonlight, and I give everyone Brené Brown, The Gifts of Imperfection. That's every class, no matter what class you take with me, you're getting those three things. Moonlight, you can have three acts in your life, right? And you could go whatever way you want to go. You can choose, like Black did, to build yourself up tough to exist, or you can choose to work through that trauma, which is not just a mental thing, it's a body thing also. It's not that you're gonna then be able to like be better or be like show up in all the right ways. There's no perfection in this. The question is, are you imploring yourself to take steps towards liberation, and liberation in the broadest of sense? And what does that look like for you, right? And I think those are choices you have to make. It's really tough because I'm not liberated in so many ways. So many ways I'm not liberated. But I'm working, and I know that Matt's working. We so trying. Now you're getting a little bit of South in me because we so trying. You
Yeah.
getting the South in me a little bit because when I get lost in it, I get lost and I go home. Yeah, in this, we're not gonna talk about this today, but I'm just gonna throw it out there. How do you liberate yourself in this administration? How do you allow people in your community to be liberated? And I hope some of the stuff we talked about earlier in this podcast helps. But I'm gonna flip this back to Matt, so that he can talk to us about this organizing principle, right? This patriarchal white supremacist settler colonialism.
Yeah, and I appreciate you connecting this to Chimamanda Adichie's work from The Danger of a Single Story. Because I think this is going to be a clue into just how, again, patriarchal, heteronormative, capitalistic, white supremacist settler colonialism can be not only that organizing principle, but that connecting tool for communities. Because,
Real fast, can you real fast, just for those that may not know, can and I'm like the fastest way possible. Can you tell us what patriarchy is? Can you tell us what white supremacy is? And can you tell us what settler colonialism is? And I know that you also brought up again capitalistic. So I know this is like five, I'm giving you four terms right now, right?
Oh, let's
Patriarchy,
do it.
white supremacy, settler colonialism, and capitalistic economy.
Right. If being trained as an analytic philosopher did anything for me, and I'm not sure it did, but if it did, it should be able to help me define shit. So hopefully I've got something for you here. Right, so patriarchy is a system of gender and oppression which systematically shifts power, access, and resources to people with the gender identity of man and shifts access, power, and resources away from people with any other gender identities. And, right. So heteronormativity. Heteronormativity is that system, that overlapping system of sex, gender, sexuality that says there are exactly two types of people in the world. There are those people in the world that are assigned female at birth, that grow up to be women, and who are sexually, emotionally, and romantically attracted to the other type of person, which is somebody who is assigned male at birth, somebody who grows up to be a man, and somebody who is emotionally, romantically, and sexually attracted exclusively to that other gender. Anybody who says that, and in a certain sense, this is maybe the only reason it makes sense to have an umbrella term like LGBTQ2S plus. Every single one of those letters stands for a community that shows the lie of heteronormativity, that there's more than just those two kinds of people.
Y'all getting a master class right now. Take out your pen, take out your paper, write your stuff down, because Matt coming through.
So capitalism. Capitalism is that economic system which ultimately sees the world in terms of profit and loss and competition rather than cooperation, and which does so by commodifying everything in the world. That's what things exist as is not as people, not as units in an ecosystem, not as living things, not as relations, but as commodities for which to potentially gain profit.
Yep, and we're seeing this with Target right now,
Right.
right? Pre-Trump, they commodified it. Now Trump, they're like, oh, whoa, 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 the market is changing. And I've actually heard this from people in the business school economists that they're like, oh, the market's been changing in relationship to this DEI stuff for the last couple of years. I did not know this. Like, people are already, we're already like down ticking in relationship to this. But continue.
White supremacy then, that system of race and oppression, which again systematically shifts access, power, resource toward those people with bodies that have been called white, and systematically shifts power, access, resources, life, land, labor, away from black folks, indigenous folks, folks of color. And then settler colonialism is that particular type of colonialism, that particular type of that particular type of invasion and extraction and exploitation that doesn't just take land, labor, resources and bring them back to where the invaders came from. The invaders actually intend to stay. And the invaders destroy to replace. Right? That's that it's that particular type of settler colonial, that particular type of colonization where indigenous communities are intended to be destroyed so that a new community can replace. And so when I look at the world right now, when I look at the Trump administration, what I see is the most significant increase in white supremacist settler colonialism, the pace of the intensity of white supremacist settler colonialism that we've seen in quite some time. And that's not at all to say that white supremacist settler colonialism ever went anywhere. It's been operating horrifically for 533 years at this point, and we haven't seen an increase in the intensity, the rapidness, the harm like this in quite some time, where almost everything that the Trump administration is doing right now can be understood as a full-throated defense of and entrenchment of white supremacist settler colonialism. Immigration, what's happening with immigrant communities, the idea that there can be such a thing as illegal immigrants in the first place is completely and totally undermined when we recognize that this entire nation is stolen land. This entire nation is land. This entire nation would not have existed without anti-Indigenous theft of land and life and anti-Black theft of bodies, labor, and life. If you look at the United States that way, you will see that no one is illegal on stolen land. And the entire immigration debate would be an entirely different thing than it currently is. If you look at what's happening in Palestine right now, and understand Israel as a settler colonial state that is intent on destroying the Palestinian nation and communities for the sake of replacing them, you will see things completely differently. And you will hear things like the suggestion from Trump that the United States take over the Gaza Strip as an absolutely horrific increase in that situation. You will see the systematic connections to things like Trump denying aid to South Africa by saying that anti-apartheid reparation laws are somehow anti-white laws. You will see a systematic connection to the suggestion that the United States recolonize the Panama Canal. You will see systematic connections to the fact that Donald Trump is suggesting that the United States colonize, recolonize Canada, recolonize Greenland. You will see systematic connections to what the Trump administration and what the right is doing to women's bodies and trans bodies as further colonization of bodies and commodifying of bodies. And we'll see
And
that,
Gaza now.
right? Absolutely, right? And so I really think having a frame like white supremacist settler colonialism gives us that way of seeing that we are not just a whole bunch of different communities all experiencing different harms right now. We have space and possibility for a united community of struggle that includes the vast, vast majority of the world, that it includes people of the global majority. Is maybe more obvious given some of the things we've said so far, but also, frankly, we need to start recognizing, and I say we, I'll say poor white folks need to start recognizing that it includes poor white folks. There's a sticker I see around my neighborhood all the time that says, "You have more in common with every houseless person than you do with any billionaire." And I want to say, come on, poor white folks, join us in recognizing that, please. Join us in recognizing that the vast majority of people who are voting for the Trump administration are getting fucked by Trump and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg, too.
I have so many questions, so many things. Man, you brought up Mark, and I'm just gonna say this on the side. Man, maybe I was just so naive, but I thought Mark was like kind of for us. Like, not saying that he was like progressive or maybe not even liberal, but centrist at least. Like NPR-y, right?
Oh, that's a hilarious way to put that. I love that.
And he's not. And he's
No,
not.
he's not even that.
Oh my God. I was like, oh my, Marky Mark. No, I was like, Mark, no. I was like, dang, you got enough. Why you want more? Like, I thought you were one of those that believed you had enough. And like, but no, he want more. He just wants
Even
more.
though he and all the other rich folks in the United States report being some of the least happy human beings on earth.
And I don't know if we've said this in this podcast, but there was a book survey that was done like maybe it was like 20 years ago, and they asked people, on their deathbed, what are their regrets? None of them had to do with money. Not one thing had to do with nothing had to do with anything that was not related to family, friends, and community. Everything on there, they five top five things. All family, friends, community. I wish I had more time. I wish I would have been more real with my family. I wish that I would have been more real with myself. I wish I would have been straightforward about someone that I with someone that I loved. It's like these type of things are the things that people are thinking on their deathbed. Not, I wish I could have bought that yacht, that next yacht.
Right.
Like, and with some with these billionaires, it's like, Mark, what are you even going for? Like, Elon, what are y'all going for? Like, you don't even know that you have more money at this point, right? It's like you get more money and your life doesn't change anymore. They have so much money that they're like, it's like, what's another billion when you
Right.
got 50 billion? Like, I don't know what that looks like. Like, you can already buy a bunch of countries. Like, whoa, I have no clue what that is.
So
I
you
know.
talked about the importance of family. So I know you just got to spend some time with your family. Anything you want to tell us about the time you got to spend
Well,
with your family?
I had a blast, so I've been up here for a minute. I've been up here 3.5 years, and like I said earlier, there are ways that this place is just hard for me to move through. There is in my life an over-pervasive loneliness. And I'm not a like a lonely type person. I make community everywhere that I've been.
Everywhere you go.
But this place has been rather difficult. Rather hard to penetrate. And I think that This place lies to itself a lot, right? It protects itself. The Star Tribune here defined itself, designed Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, as the happiest city in the U.S. And I read it, and one of my students, I was talking about Minnesota, brought it up, and I was like, happy for who? Black people tried to burn this place down 4 years ago. Like, have you been on the light rail? Happy for who? No one even rides the light rail because so many people are doing drugs. My mom was here a year ago, and we took a 30-minute train, light rail ride, and there was a guy in the back that had a knife to another guy's throat the entire time. And it's like, happy for who? Like, this is a wild place. And so I've just been, I haven't been able to, transition into this type of space really well. And so my sister, her husband, and two kids came. I'm gonna name them, April, Mark, Ember, and Willow, the Whitehead family. They came up here, spent the last couple days with me. I got to take them to a play called Milo. And if you're in Minnesota and you're reading and you're listening to this, go see Milo. It is a great play, even though there's a lot of critiques. I got lots of critiques, right?
Nice.
I'm in there, I walk in, I sit down. I'm saying way too much, but I'm just giving it. I'm in there, I walk in, I sit down. Me, my two nieces are the only black folks in the theater. It's all white. At the end of the theater, I did turn around and there was a mom with her two kids, two black kids. Four black kids, two black adults in this entire space. Pretty good size theater. Pretty good size theater. But the main the child actress who's acting is a little black boy, right? And he's going through just like the black tropes, like he's got to fend for himself. He's got to know how to ride the tube. He's got a his mom is in prison. Wildly, his mom is white in prison, but his mom is in prison, right? It's like, and I'm like sitting here as the black person in this space with all these white people, and this is what you are like conditioning these people to think
To see.
about this little black boy. And I'm not saying we don't need to tell those stories because we need the Moonlight type stories. We need them. But I was just like, this is like what's that type of art they talk about? It's not gore art. What is that? There's a particular like type of art that they talk about, and it's like, but anyway, this is like a fantasy, right? This is like confirming all of the things that organizing principle. And so it hurt my heart in that ways. But the boy is so imaginative. The girls loved it. They're laughing, they're giggling, they're all over the place. But they don't even know the subliminal messages that are being told to them, right? And
And
so,
this is again why folks need to listen to The Danger of a Single Story, right?
yes.
This is exactly, Adichie would tell us, yes, absolutely, this story needs to be told. And there's a lot of danger in this being the only
Only
story being
story
told,
that you, yes.
right?
Yes. And I think those are the black stories that are like propped up, right? No one wants it. Why would you tell like a story like mine, right? Where you have a little black boy that becomes a professor, right? It's like that doesn't fit the narrative. It's not the narrative of this organizing principle. And so it's like difficult, yeah, super difficult. But we did that. They went snow tubing. It snowed yesterday like
Nice.
7 inches. This is their first time like seeing snow fall
What'd they
and.
think of the snow?
They lost it. They lost it. They're out there kicking, rolling, doing all types of stuff. I was so mad because I wish that I would have got glow in the dark. I know this is bad for the environment. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Bad for the environment. But I wanted to like go out and throw glow in the dark over the sun. I mean, over the snow. And then have them go out and play and stuff because it's just so much fun. I did it as a kid.
And
I grew
don't
up
hold
in the
on.
90s. Yes.
Don't apologize for that, because it's not that we don't need to be concerned about the environment, but capitalism gives us the most green capitalism gives us the most fucked up ways of thinking about these things. It tries to tell us that the burden, the obligation, the responsibility for a clean and healthy earth is on us not doing things like that. And
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
sorry, the responsibility is on Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates to stop fucking up the environment in those ways.
It's on this
Right.
organizing principle. It's on this organizing principle. And we didn't talk about this before, so Matt may end up cutting this, but I'm gonna ask him, and he can put it in or not. How does it feel to be a homeowner? How does it feel? As millennials is struggling. We own our homes at 1/6 of the rate that boomers owned it. So Matt got a house in his 30s, and we proud. How you feel? How does it feel?
I appreciate that. I absolutely appreciate that. It feels a lot of things. It feels a lot of things, Dwight. It's super exciting in some ways. In part, I didn't know that I didn't know that I'd ever be in a place where I felt stable enough in relationship to my life, in relationship to my community, in relationship to my career, in relationship to finances, that would ever be a possibility for me. So there's absolutely some super, super, super cool stuff connected to that. I'll also say the racial justice activist and enthusiast in me feels a type of way about white people owning land in a settler colonial system. And
I think
so
I'm gonna push on that because, right? If you are creating places of refuge for people that are marginalized by this organizing principle, I don't think anyone is mad about those people being a part of the community or owning things. It's that those people, not j and I'm gonna say not just white people, those people, period. That ellipses, actually. Those people that hold themselves to that organizing principle and then treat other people in the world that way. And I'm sorry, you are out here, investing in so many communities that are not yours, right? Not like yours, right? Even though they are yours, right? And I think those are the people that we need to be buying homes. Those are the people that we need to be living alongside brown and black people, not like my neighbor who, I don't own this home. I'm renting it. And my first day moving in here, and he might be able to hear me through the walls. My first day moving in here, I'm out, with my friend that helped me move into this place, Abe. And, we don't work all day, so I'm smoking a cigarette. And he pops around the corner. I'm just here making sure everything's above board. Man, I looked at
Ooh,
him.
talk about some fucking coded dog whistle anti-black language. Holy shit.
I looked at him. I said, "Dr. Lewis." I
Good
said,
for you.
"My boy, I need to make sure you're above board."
Yeah, right?
And I'm like, "What board are you under?" Like, literally, that's how I was like. Dr. Lewis, where, come up here to me. Are you above board? That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
Black joy, hallelujah. Black joy.
You should have said you get any $500,000 grants recently?
No, I mean, he ain't got, he been, he like, he look like he'd be struggling, but, he got a full house.
So no, I appreciate you saying that because it reminds me too that right, really what I need to be reminding myself is there are a whole bunch of obligations that I take on as a homeowner, as a white settler, colonizer, homeowner, to remember to continue fighting for land back, to continue thinking about the ways in which I can be in solidarity with the resistance and resilience of Tualatin Kalapuya peoples. of Chinook peoples, of Multnomah peoples, of Clackamas peoples, of many different peoples, of indigenous peoples of the Lower Columbia River, whose rightful unceded occupied land that home exists on.
And I'm again gonna encourage this to everyone, not just black people, but to white, brown, whatever, however you show up. And I'm gonna kind of close this out a little bit by reading a paragraph from this. Somewhere along, so let me actually start in the previous paragraph. Nothing could hurt me, I thought. The joy of that moment was found in my indescribable sense of being safe. Somewhere along the way, I lost that. The world reveals itself as unsafe, and you can't turn back from what you've seen or what you know. This is especially true for many black folks. And there's many of folks that she don't write on here because she's worried about black joy. So, other people, put yourself in this as well. This is especially true for many black folks. Life teaches us that, in fact, you cannot do everything. And no, you cannot be just anything. Or if you want to do or be anything, it's going to require sacrifices that may not have it's going to require sacrifice that you may not have the capacity to make in the moment. My body longs again for that feeling of being uncontainable. I want to burst down the doors, break the chains, and remove the limits from myself and my people. I want to feel what it is like to go to the absolute brink of my imagination. I'm trying. I'm trying. I'm trying every day to regain and complain and to regain and reclaim that sense of myself, the sense of being bigger than even my body can hold. And I end with this, in the same way that we talk about larger, freer, more loving, right? I want you to claim to work towards that sense of being bigger than even your body can hold. That's what this podcast is about. That's what we're trying to move towards. And it's okay to fail in the process. You're not going to get there unless you have. Perfection is not the answer. Holding on to the imaginary, to new futures, and to the people in your community that show up and fight against this organizing principle is the ways that we're going to move forward. And the ways that we're going to be able to live in this Trump administration. Matt, if you have any last words, you can go ahead, jump in.
Thank you, Dwight. Yeah, I so appreciate everything you said there, and you sharing that story, those stories of how Black joy is possible. And I think that's something that all of us, regardless of our racialized background, our racialized identity, need to hear those stories. And it reminds me of a quote, actually, again from Chimamanda Adichie's "The Danger of a Single Story," that I want to close out with from my side of things. Adichie says here about different stories and their relationship to power. She says, "Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person."
Ooh.
The Palestinian poet Mourid Barghouti writes that if you want to dispossess a people, the simplest way to do it is to tell their story and to start with secondly. Start the story with the arrows of the Native Americans and not with the arrival of the British, and you have an entirely different story. Start the story with the failure of the African state and not with the colonial creation of the African state, and you have an entirely different story.
Yes.
And so again, hearing these pluralistic stories as ways for us to come together in community across difference, that's what we're here for. And that's what I couldn't possibly be more grateful, more appreciative of being in a space with you where we try to bring those stories together. I got so much love for you, Dwight. I
Thank you,
can't tell
Sam. You
you.
know
I
I love you
can't tell
too.
you how much I appreciate you and spending time to work on something like this together.
Same, same. And we're gonna say this too. We care about y'all. We love y'all that, keep showing us support. Keep coming and listen that keep coming to listen. But we're gonna do this whether you're listening or not. We gonna put this out into the world. But we appreciate you for showing up. And we're sending you all the lovely energy on whatever day that you're watching this or listening to it. Thank you, thank you. Peace, peace.